Shalom Haravarnex. We're now ready to begin our next session of our class, The First Regathering, Modern Israel. And we're going to pick it up on session 37, which is page 304 in your notebooks. So let's do a quick review of where we've been last session. Last session, we took a look at the Nakba celebration that was instituted by Yasser Arafat in opposition to Israel Independence Day. And so that has been a very recent development. Again, it is directly aimed at blunting the effect of Israel Independence Day. And a key symbol of the Nakba protests is the key. As you see this young woman holding the key, here's another poster showing the key, and the key being the idea that we own the key to the houses. And we will return, and we will open our doors and return to our houses. We will return. That's the idea of Nakba. Well, President Clinton instituted the Camp David talks because of the violence that was going on in the Middle East. And you can see here Ehud Barak on the left, President Clinton in the center, and Yasser Arafat on the right. And even though Ehud Barak was willing to make far-reaching concessions for peace, he proposed to Yasser Arafat that he would receive 96% of the West Bank. And as you can see on the map here, the Palestinian territory is the darker area, with the lighter area being Israeli territory around running through the middle of the northern part of the West Bank, with a corridor running down to the Jordan Valley, and then at Jerusalem, another corridor running down to the Jordan Valley. And of course, that would be for security purposes. So they offered 96% of the West Bank to the Palestinians, and as well, they offered a divided Jerusalem. And here's a map of the Israeli offer at the Camp David 2000 talks. Again, the lighter area is the Israeli area, and the darker area is the Palestinian area, and you can see it runs right through the middle of Jerusalem, East and West Jerusalem. It would be a divided city. But Yasser Arafat refused to accept any terms and offered no counter proposals. Instead, he began to, he had set up the Al-Aqsa Intifada, or the Battle for Jerusalem, months before, and now he was primed to institute it. And he had poured, as one commentator said, gasoline was poured all over the issue, only needed a match. And the match was Likud chairman Ariel Sharon visiting the Temple Mount. He visited the Mount like any other Jewish person has the right to do. He had 1,000 security personnel with him. But that was the incident that Arafat used to ignite the Intifada. As the violence mounted, the two sides were moving toward a ceasefire agreement when a very unfortunate incident happened. This young man, Rami Al-Dura, and his father were caught in a crossfire between IDF troops and a Palestinian machine gun nest. And Rami was apparently hit by a bullet and killed. The initial investigation by the IDF said that their bullet might have killed the boy, but a thorough three-week investigation weeks later showed that the bullet that killed Rami came from Palestinian weapons. And but the IDF was blamed anyway. Tanzim leader Marwan Barghouti wanted the Intifada to continue under all terms, without any kind of a ceasefire. He's the leader of the Tanzim, which is the youth paramilitary organization associated with Fatah. We also talked about the media bias that was very evident against Israel. Now, during the violence, this picture and caption appeared in the media, and I reproduced the caption there: an Israeli policeman and a Palestinian on the Temple Mount. The clear implication is that this Israeli policeman has beaten this Palestinian youth, and he's bleeding and bloody. But if you'll notice in the background, there's a gas station and Hebrew writing. And as the father of the young man stated in a letter to the media, there are no gas stations on the Temple Mount. And in fact, my son was attacked. My son is this isn't a Palestinian in the picture. That is my son. He is a Jewish student studying in Israel, and he was attacked in East Jerusalem by Arabs. And of course, after a half-hearted retraction and a lot of complaints, then the newspapers printed a full retraction and a full explanation of what happened. And the key is that gas station behind the Israeli policeman. Here's a picture of the Temple Mount. Folks, you will not find any gas stations on the Temple Mount. The report was so biased and so inaccurate that it became kind of a poster child for media bias. Another very brutal event that happened during this time was the lynching of two reserve IDF soldiers. They were taken into the police station by the Palestinian authorities. Over a thousand Palestinians surrounded the police station, broke in, killed them, and desecrated at least one of the bodies, and it made world news. This is the cover of U.S. News and World Report that covered the issue. The Palestinians did not like that because their brutality was actually broadcast to the world. The fact that the Palestinians were training their children to hate Israelis and Israel was seen in the fact that as IDF troops searched for terrorists, they began to find evidence of this training. Here's a picture of a one-year-old or less, a little toddler, dressed up in martyr gear with an explosive belt around his waist. His family called this picture just a joke. Now, the biggest hypocrite in regard to using children as martyrs was Yasser Arafat's own wife. When she was interviewed regarding the use of children as martyrs, she said if she had a son, she'd be proud to sacrifice him as a martyr to the cause. And she affirmed that she was just as patriotic as her husband, who was hoping to be a martyr. Well, words are cheap for Yasser Arafat's wife because she does not have a son. This is a picture of her with her daughter, and she doesn't even live in Palestinian territory. She lives in Europe. I finished by talking about the lecture given to us by Major Israel when I was there in Israel on the Tsar El volunteer program. And he explained how the use of children as soldiers was instituted by the PLO in 1982. And Israel first encountered that when they went into Lebanon. Major Israel lost 11 men because the children would wave at them as they drove by with their tanks, and then as soon as they drove by, fire at them with an RPG. And of course, Israel pursues a purity of arms doctrine. They try to avoid civilian casualties, so here their doctrine is not to kill children, and yet the children are trying to kill them. So Major Israel was quite an inspiring man. In spite of his wounds, he was moving forward with life. Well, that brings us to page 304 in your notebook. And at the top of the page, November 2000, Israel begins to target these terrorists. In November, Israeli helicopter gunships successfully attacked Hussein Abayat, a senior leader of the Tanzim militia that had spearheaded the current Intifada. His death was the first assassination of a senior member of Fatah, which is part of Arafat's political organization. Hussein al-Sheikh, one of the leaders of the movement, stated, "We in Fatah consider ourselves in a state of war with Israel." Now, the U.S. had consistently condemned Israel's targeting of terrorists, but Lieutenant General Shaul Mofaz defended the policy in July of 2001 by stating, "What would you do if 40 suicide attacks were carried out against your country?" Good statement. What would we do here in the United States if 40 suicide attacks impacted us. All right, November 12th, 2000, Leah Rabin dies at age 72. Leah Rabin, widow of the late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, died of cancer. She was buried on Mount Herzl Military Cemetery in Jerusalem next to her husband. And here is a photograph of the burial site and the two stones marking their graves. Leah Rabin is the white stone on the left, and the dark stone on the right marks the grave of Yitzhak Rabin. Very simple and very fitting and dignified memorial to these two people. All right, let's move to November 26, 2000. International inquiry into the Intifada starts. You can read the comments I've made about that, but I'd like to make an additional comment, and that comment is deja vu. We've seen this all before. We've seen at least five previous international inquiries. Remember, inquiry number one was the Commission of Inquiry in 1921. Number two was the Royal Commission in 1930 that issued the Shaw Report. Number three was the Peel Commission Inquiry in 1937. Number four was the Palestine Partition Commission in 1938. Number five was the UNSCOPE International Inquiry Commission in 1947. So here we have a sixth international inquiry into what's going on in Israel. Israel is constantly under the international microscope. Constantly. All right. We come to the year 2001. On page 304, we start in February 6, 2001. Ariel Sharon elected Israel's prime minister. Ariel Sharon was elected Israel's 11th prime minister in a landslide vote over Labor candidate Ehud Barak. And here is the official portrait of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. He had played already a significant part in the history of Israel, and he had more to play as well. God had more in store for him as prime minister. Now, Ariel Sharon is very nationalist in outlook, being the former general and defense minister. In his swearing-in ceremony, he stated he was prepared for peace, but would insist on a reduction in violence before starting negotiations again. He was unique in that he took the oath of office with his hand on a Hebrew Old Testament. This was a first for an Israeli prime minister. His aides said that the gesture symbolically reaffirmed the Jewish connection to the Holy Land, an historical connection that goes back thousands of years. In March, he asserted his goal to increase Aliyah. Aliyah, of course, is immigration. His goal, by 2020, most of the Jewish nation would be gathered to Israel. That was his hope. All right, page 305, top of the page. Knesset returns to the parliamentary system. The 1966 electoral system that consisted of separate ballots for prime minister and for party was repealed March 7th, 2001. So now Israel is back on the you vote for the party, and the leader of the party becomes the prime minister. So they're back on that system again. Next headline I have, European Union to monitor PA funds. You can read about that on your own, but they have always done a very, very poor job of monitoring the funds that have gone into the Middle East. And so a lot of that money has been directed toward terrorism and skimmed off by PA officials for their own private wealth. March 29th, 2001, IDF opens an offensive against Force 17. Three successful terrorist bombing attacks struck Israel late in March. Following the wave of terrorism that struck Israel, the government convened an emergency security cabinet meeting. Next sentence is important. Mark it up. Put a highlight over it or something. During the meeting, it was decided to undertake a consistent, protracted campaign against terrorists, their accomplices, and their commanders. No more would Israel move just in relation to incidents. She would be more proactive. Prime Minister Sharon stated, "The days of restraint are over." IDF helicopter gunships attacked five targets of Force 17, And remember, this is Yasser Arafat's presidential guard, his own personal guard. 417 targets that were hit, one in Ramallah and four in Gaza. Now, these attacks were driven neither by punishment nor by revenge. That was not the motivation for these attacks. The motivation for these attacks was the right of Israel to self-defense. And these attacks were Prime Minister Sharon's first military response since he took office 3 weeks earlier. Hatzofeh, an Israeli right-wing newspaper, commented, and this is worth noting, you could highlight this comment, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was elected in order to put a stop to the shedding of Israeli citizens' blood, which his predecessor failed to do. No benefit will accrue to Israel for showing restraint, because the Arab world sees this as weakness. And that is exactly true. Remember, the Arab world venerates power. Right, might makes right, is the Arab view. If you are powerful and you're strong, you take what you want. If you are weak, you negotiate or you show restraint. And this is exactly the opposite of Western thinking. In Western thinking, you're strong if you show restraint. You're strong if you negotiate. Right, might does not make right. And so these two cultures are at opposition to each other. And Israel is caught right in the middle with the West criticizing her when she shows power. But when she negotiates, then the Arabs think she's weak and that they can take advantage of her. So she is caught between two opposing cultures. All right, on the next page, on the bottom of that page, you see an article entitled 417, and you can read that article for yourself. That article goes onto page 307. So you can read all about 417, Yasser Arafat's personal presidential guard. So now let's pick it up on May 14th. This is toward the bottom of page 307. May 14th, 2001, Israel Independence Day. And in that paragraph, I have laid out some of the statistics for the nation in 2001. You can go ahead and read those statistics for yourselves. Now let's move on to page 308. And another very serious development in the life of the nation Israel. April 24th, 2001. Kinneret hits the lowest level ever. The Kinneret, of course, is the Sea of Galilee. And the Sea of Galilee is the major freshwater source for Israel, their major reservoir. So when that freshwater source is drying up, it is a serious matter, serious business. So let's take a look at what was happening in 2001. On April 24th, 2001, the lake, the Sea of Galilee, the Kinneret, was at the red line, a minus 213 meters below the normal level. If the water drops three more meters to a minus 216 meters below the normal level, Israel's water supply will be endangered and the lake could suffer irreparable ecological damage. And the problem lies in the fact that there are saline springs in the bottom of the Sea of Galilee, and the weight of the freshwater prevents the saline springs from sending their salt water into the Sea of Galilee. But if the water level reduces to the point, to the black line, then those springs can start pushing their salty water, non-potable water, into the lake. And, of course, that could damage the lake in an irreparable fashion. Turned it into a salt lake rather than into a freshwater lake. So that's a very big concern. At present, water can only be supplied from natural resources, which have become seriously depleted after three consecutive winters of drought. So Israel is going to have to take stock of issues in at the issue in 2001 and start developing other water supplies mighty fast. Now, I visited Tabqa, Israel, in 2009. And here's a picture of a postcard that I got at Tabqa, and I just scanned it in. And the reason I scanned it in is because of the water level. Notice the water level there. There is no beach, and the water is up to the rocks, where the church sits, it's on that rock outcropping. And on the left, you can see the water's right up to the stairs going down into the lake. So that's the normal water level, the Sea of Galilee. But when I was there in 2009, this is what it looked like. There's our church at Tabqa, and you can see the rock outcropping is clearly up on a dry beach. The stairs are to the left of that picture. But all that should be underwater, and it is not underwater. Now I'm going to walk a little bit to my left and turn around, and there you get an idea of the size of the beach. You see how far down the water. All these people standing on the left should be up to their necks in water. So that's about 5 feet there. So it looks like the lake is down a good, well, it's down a good 20 feet or so from its normal level. And that's a lot of water. So there's the way Tabqa looked in 2009 during this drought. The lake was way down. There's a shot down the shoreline of the Sea of Galilee. And again, you can see the evidence of how the water has retreated, and it should be right up to the water level should be right up to the land on the right there, on the right. So it's very, very important. Now here's a graph of the Kinneret water levels from 2004 through 2012. And as you can see, the water level has basically found between the two red lines. Now, the line at the top is the upper red line, the line in the middle is the lower red line, and the line at the bottom is the black line. And the water level is serious when it lies between the two upper lines, but when it drops between the two lower lines, then it's getting dangerous. And if it drops down to that black line, at minus 215 meters below the normal level, then the lake could become polluted. So you see the drought has been going on from at least here the records are 2004 through 2012. The drought was already going on in 2001. It has been going on for over a decade. The water level's been quite low. All right, let's move on to page 308 on your notebook, May 4th, just drop down a little bit on the page. The Mitchell Report is issued. The Sharm el-Sheikh Fact-Finding Committee, also known as the Mitchell Committee, issued its report regarding the cause of the Al-Aqsa Intifada on May 4th, 2001. And then some basic recommendations were proposed. Those basic recommendations start about the middle of the page. And here are the basic recommendations of the Mitchell Report. Number one, a cessation of violence. Number two, resumption of security cooperation between the two sides. Number three, 10 points, 10 steps to rebuild confidence. And I've listed those 10 steps on page 308 and 309. First of all, the PA must take all measures necessary to stop terrorist operations. Secondly, the Palestinian Authority must arrest and jail all terrorists operating within its jurisdiction. Note that one. That's an important one. Third, the government of Israel must freeze all settlement construction. Fourth, both sides must implement a cooling-off period. Fifth, both sides must reduce tensions and prevent violent demonstrations. Sixth, both sides must discipline their actions and their responses. Next, both sides must foster understanding and tolerance and abstain from incitement. Both sides must minimize the economic and social impact of the violence. Both sides must respect the holy places. And finally, there will be no international protection force unless both sides agree to it. So those are the 10 steps to rebuild confidence. And then the fourth recommendation was to resume negotiations. The Palestinians accepted the report and declared that they wanted to use it as a basis to reconvene the American-led Sharm el-Sheikh talks. In addition, they stated that they were ready for an immediate ceasefire based on the principles laid down in the report. Israel likewise gave the okay to the Mitchell Report, although they had two reservations. One, the demand for an absolute settlement freeze, and two, the criticism of IDF operations. The United States endorsed the report and urged both sides to cease violence immediately as a first step toward restoring trust. In response, on May 23, 2001, Ariel Sharon halted all IDF preemptive strikes against the PA and will maintain the ceasefire except in cases of genuine danger to human life. That's the first practical response by Israel, not by the PA. He urged the PA to agree to an immediate ceasefire, but the PA continued to carry out acts of terrorism and violence with even greater intensity. From May 23rd, when the Israeli ceasefire was ordered, until May 29, 1 week, there were 96 terrorist attacks. So the PA seems to be speaking out of both sides of their mouth, right? On one side, they say, we'll use this as a framework for peace. But on the other side of the coin, they don't stop terrorism. Well, by June of 2001, next month, a tenuous ceasefire had been established. But now let's move to page 310, and we look at June 6th. June 6th, CIA Director George Tenet sent to the Middle East. With the ceasefire more or less holding, President Bush sent CIA Director George Tenet to the region to mediate a round of security talks. The focus of Director Tenet's visit will be the unwillingness of the PA, the Palestinian Authority, to arrest terrorists. Remember that point I mentioned to you a few minutes ago? That was a big key sticking point. The government of Israel has given the Palestinian Authority a list of 34 Hamas and Islamic Jihad activists it wants arrested. How did the PA respond? The PA retorted that the arrest of Palestinian activists, notice they are not terrorists, they are activists, is unequivocally unacceptable. So on one hand, they say, The recommendations are acceptable, and then on the other hand, they say at least one of the provisions is equivocally unacceptable. Now, Israel, note the next sentence, highlight this. Take a yellow marker, highlight it. Israel had already begun to implement the settlement freeze by not approving an additional construction in the settlements, so they stopped approving additional construction, and by ordering the IDF to dismantle all new outposts set up by settlers. So Israel had already begun to implement the settlement freeze as well. However, how did the PA react? The PA said the freeze formula worked out with the American government was a trick. Wasn't genuine. June 12, 2001. Prime Minister Sharon accepted the ceasefire security plan put forward by CIA Director Tenet. Yasser Arafat gave reluctant approval to the Tenet plan only after Director Tenet threatened to leave the region. Was it a genuine approval? No. Violence and terrorism continued. For example, July 18th, the first mortar shells fall on Jerusalem, on the capital city. You can read a little bit more about that in that paragraph. August 1st, Israel strikes out against Hamas. So they begin to take on that faction. Let's go to page 311. August 27th, 2001, Israel strikes against the PFLP. Israeli helicopters fired rockets at a building in PA-controlled Ramallah, killing the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. So that organization is sending terrorists into Israel. So Israel began to deal with them as well. All right, now at the bottom of page 311, September 10th, 2001, the first Israeli Arab suicide bomber. Up to this point in time, all suicide bombers were Palestinian Arabs. But now this is a man with Israeli citizenship. He's an Israeli Arab. And he became the first Israeli Arab suicide bomber. First experience in that realm. All right. At the bottom of the page, September 11th, 2001. This is a day that will be remembered in American history for a long time, if not forever, as long as America exists. Islamic terrorists attack New York and Washington, D.C. So I see that it's about time for your break. So go ahead and take your break, and we will pick it up on September 11th, 2001. Okay, let's pick it up again where we left off. We left off on page 311, the bottom of the page, September 11th, 2001, Islamic terrorists attack New York and Washington, D.C. The response of Israel to those attacks? Israel observed a national day of mourning in solidarity with the U.S. after the deadly terrorist attacks against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And, of course, here's one of the famous pictures that has been burned itself into the psyche of the American. There is the World Trade Center burning after being attacked by the two aircraft. September 11th. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon told Americans, "Our hearts are with you, and we are ready to provide any assistance at any time." Israel declared Wednesday a day of mourning and set up a blood bank for the injured. So Israel is trying to practically identify and support the United States. "This is a war between good and evil and between humanity and the bloodthirsty," said Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. He added that the attacks would be a turning point against the war against international terror. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat said, "I send my condolences and the condolences of the Palestinian people to the American President Bush, to American President Bush and his government, and to the American people for this terrible act," Arafat told reporters in Gaza. "We can completely condemn this serious operation. We were completely shocked. It's unbelievable, unbelievable, unbelievable," says a visibly upset Arafat. Well, if you believe that, if you believe he's sincere, I have a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. Government buildings in Israel lower their flags to half-mast. There's a very visible symbolic identification with the United States, honoring the dead. Candles and banners outside the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv. Here are average Israelis coming to the U.S. Embassy and expressing their grief over the attack on the United States. And in Palestinian territories, there was some expressions of identification. Schoolgirls in Palestine pray in a moment of silence, praying for the United States. But those expressions of condolences to the United States was not all that happened in the Palestinian territories. In contrast, approximately 4,000 Palestinians took to the streets in Nablus to celebrate the attack, realizing that the celebrations would shock the world. PA police quelled the celebrations and confiscated videotape of the cameraman who filmed it. Yasser Arafat's Tanzim militiamen threatened the life of a Palestinian cameraman who worked for the Associated Press. We're on page 312 now. They threatened the life of this Palestinian who worked for the Associated Press. They told him that if the footage was shown, he would die. Freedom of the press, the PA territories. The Foreign Press Association sharply criticized the PA for suppressing the videotape of Palestinian celebrations in Nablus. But of course, criticism means nothing to the Palestinian Authority and to Hamas. Celebrations by Hamas members occurred in Gaza City, Ramallah, and Jericho. Conspiracy theories in the Arab world say that Israel was behind the attack. Here are a number of the conspiracy theories, various rumors. Number one, first conspiracy theory. 4,000 Jews who worked in the Trade Center were mysteriously absent September 11th. In other words, all the Jews got word of the attack and didn't show up at the target. Well, let me just share with you a unique experience that puts that to bed, the lie to bed. in response to that rumor, that conspiracy theory, I want to share with you the experience of Mark Sokolow. He was working on the 38th floor of the South Tower. His office was evacuated. He escaped unharmed before the second plane hit the North Tower. Nobody had told him to stay home from work that day. He was conspicuously present in the World Trade Center. Then later, January 27, 2002, he and his wife had traveled to Israel. In January 27, 2002, and his wife and their daughters were shopping in Jerusalem, and they suffered minor injuries from a nearby suicide bomber. Interesting. He was not protected from the terrorists in any way, shape, or form. But of course, the rumor is different. In contrast, September11news.com reported that not a single Saudi lost their life in the Trade Center towers. And that's extreme as well, because a number of the hijackers were Saudis. So what about the Saudi terrorists? So that's one form of the rumor that got going around. The second conspiracy theory or rumor, 5 Jews were arrested for being spotted videotaping the attack and dancing in celebration. That's another one. Thirdly, another rumor, the Al-Watan Qatar newspaper named Ariel Sharon as the brains behind the attack. So you see, he planned it all. Fourthly, the Gulf News, a daily newspaper in the United Arab Emirates, reported Salim Abu Sultan, a Palestinian diplomat, stating, "I can smell Israeli fingers behind this. The scope of the attack was beyond the capability of Arabs. Only Israelis have the abilities to do such things. It's all Israel's fault." 5, many Muslims blamed Israel's spy agency, the Mossad. So, of course, Israel is blamed no matter what happens. On September 18th, 2001, yielding to diplomatic pressure, Arafat ordered his forces to halt all violence directed at Israeli targets. Israel responded by halting military strikes, withdrawing several tank positions, and halting the targeted killing of terrorists. So you see, that's always been Israel's response. You leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. The PA stated that they were working hard to make the truth stick. Hamas stated that they would be willing to suspend attacks inside Israel unless provoked. The Israelis were skeptical about Arafat's intentions. Do you really blame them? Note this next statement by spokesman Doré Gold. This is worth a highlight as well. Spokesman Doré Gold stated, "In the past, his ceasefires have had the shelf life of roughly 1 week." However, by September 24th, a mere 6 days after Arafat had ordered a ceasefire, 99 terrorist attacks had occurred. So this ceasefire didn't even last a day. During the 6 days after Arafat ordered his ceasefire publicly, 99 terrorist attacks still went on. See what Israel's up against? She's up against a very determined enemy that will stop at nothing. All right, now we're on page 313, November 11th, 2001. President Bush addresses the UN over the issue. He called for an end to the violence. Of course, was just words. That wouldn't move the PA, that's for sure. October 17, 2001, Cabinet Minister Rehavam Zvi assassinated. The PFLP, that's the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, claimed responsibility for the assassination of the Minister of Tourism. It was the first assassination of a cabinet minister in the state's 53-year history. You can read more about that on page 313. Drop down to the bottom of page 313, November 26th, and we're approaching the end of year 2001 now. November 26, 2001, General Zinni arrives in Israel. Retired U.S. Marine General Anthony Zinni arrived in Israel in an attempt to mediate a ceasefire. He unsuccessfully attempted to prod Mr. Arafat into initiating a meaningful crackdown against Hamas and Islamic Jihad. General Zinni gave Arafat a list of 30 Palestinian extremists to arrest. The PA only picked up 12. So 30 of them were on the list, 12 were picked up, and of the 12, only a few were placed under a real arrest. Page 314. After three fruitless weeks, General Zinni was recalled because the Palestinian terror attacks continued unabated. You guys, let me just share this time that I have never met an Israeli that does not want peace. Now, I will admit, I don't know any Israeli extremists, and there are extremists, as we have seen. But all the Israelis I have known and talked to have said, why do they want to destroy us? If you don't like us, just leave us alone, and we'll leave you alone. And that's the idea. If you don't like us, leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. But the problem is, Israel is never left alone. So Israel has to constantly defend themselves, and then they get criticized by the world for doing so. All right, December 13th, 2001, Israel severs ties to Arafat, calling him irrelevant. In an emergency meeting following a deadly terror attack near the Emmanuel settlement, the cabinet declared PA Chairman Arafat, quote, no longer relevant. The cabinet approved military operations against the terrorist infrastructure in the West Bank and Gaza. Yasser Arafat will not be harmed, and every effort will be taken to avoid injury to Palestinian civilians. Water, food, electricity, and fuel will continue to be supplied. See, the area will not be put under siege. You know, you're not besieging an area if you supply water, food, electricity, and fuel. But of course, the accusation always is that Israel has Gaza or the West Bank under siege. That's simply not true. They've always supplied necessities of life and emergency aid to the Palestinians. Israel feels that the Oslo Accords are still in effect, but that Arafat is not fulfilling the terms of the agreement to fight terror. Accordingly, Israeli tanks stationed themselves 200 yards from Arafat's headquarters in Ramallah, effectively trapping him in the facility. The IDF also toppled the Voice of Palestine radio antenna. The PA called Israel's actions a declaration of war against the PA. Well, Israel has never declared war on the Palestinian people. Its actions have always been based on self-defense. But Israel was fed up because this was the ninth, count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. This was the ninth ceasefire initiative embraced by Mr. Arafat that has failed. Somehow his peace and ceasefire initiatives only have a shelf life of 1 week, as Dorie Gold mentioned. U.S. President Bush bluntly assailed Arafat for failing to end the violence. Now, this was a distinct change. Up to this point, President Bush called for both sides to end the violence. But now, the focus of responsibility shifted squarely onto the shoulders of Arafat. In response, Yasser Arafat called for a complete cessation of armed attacks and military activities. His remarks were directed at Islamic Jihad and the PFLP. Arafat stated that he had reached an agreement with Hamas to suspend suicide and mortar attacks. Israel, who wants results, not words, found that nothing had changed. Statistics revealed that the attacks only dropped from 18 per day to 11 per day. So that's the Arafat's definition of a ceasefire. Instead of 18 terrorist attacks a day, we'll only do 11 a day. Accordingly, Israel kept Arafat penned up in his Ramallah office, refusing to allow him to attend Christmas Eve services in Bethlehem, for example, which he would often use for propaganda purposes. Few Arab leaders offered him support, which was new. Israel stated that his confinement would end if he became a constructive partner for peace. Israel still insisted that he must arrest the assassins of Rehavam Zvi. That had still not occurred. All right, we're at the bottom of page 314. December 31st, 2001. This is the last day of the year. Most difficult year ever. As 2001 drew to a close, the Israeli police determined that it had been the most difficult year with regard to security since Israel became a state in 1948. Minister of Foreign Affairs, Shimon Peres, would also comment that 2001 was the most trying time for Israel, the most trying time that Israel has had to face since its statehood 53 years ago. In addition, immigration statistics were down as well. Aliyah has dropped by nearly 28% in 2001. The drop in immigration was attributed to the economic situation and the security situation. Despite the drop, 43,477 made Aliyah in 2001. So even though the drop occurred, 43,000, almost 43,500 Jewish people immigrated to Israel in 2001. All right, that brings us to the year 2002 on page 315, and the year began in a rather auspicious manner. The Karine A Palestinian freighter captured. Israeli commandos seized the PA-owned freighter Karine A, capturing 50 tons of weapons destined for the PA. And the next three sentences are well worth highlighting. The ship is owned by the Palestinian Authority and commanded by a Palestinian Authority naval officer. The weapons, valued at $15 million, included long-range missiles, mortars, mines, and advanced explosives. And here's a photograph of the armaments aboard the Karine that were all laid out by the IDF after capturing the ship. Look at that. That's a... Well, I don't know what happened there, folks. There we go. This is all the armament laid out by the IDF after capturing that ship. Next sentence. The PA is not permitted to have these weapons under the peace accords they have signed with Israel. Yet they were shipping them in. The captain of the ship, Omar Akawi, admitted that the arms were indeed headed for the PA. He was told to deliver the arms off the coast of Gaza. Secretary of State Colin Powell called Yasser Arafat and demanded an urgent and full explanation. Vice President Cheney stated that it was clear that Arafat, or people very close to him, were involved in the arms smuggling attempt. Caught red-handed, the PA denied any involvement. Yasser Arafat's own words, February 1, 2002, 1 month after the interception, "We have no connection with the weapons ship. It's all a PR trick by the Israeli Mossad," that's the Secret Service. "In the storehouse, I have enough weapons, much more than on that ship." So the ship is owned by the PA. It's commanded by a PA naval officer. The captain admits that the arms are headed for the Palestinian Authority, and yet Yasser Arafat says, "We had nothing to do with it. It's all the Mossad's fault. It's all Israel's trick." Such a man for his duplicity. The truth means nothing. The truth meant nothing to Yasser Arafat. All right, bottom of the page. Israel continues to confine Arafat to his Ramallah headquarters. So Israel has imposed a travel ban upon Yasser Arafat until he arrests the killers of Israeli Cabinet Minister Rehavam Zvi. Cabinet Minister Zvi was assassinated in the fall of 2001. We are now in January 2002. The first hints of the U.S. severing ties with Arafat surfaced with the disclosure that the Bush administration is considering sanctions against the Palestinian Authority. Page 316. So, Arafat ordered the arrest of the PFLP leader Ahmed Saadat in connection with the killing of Cabinet Minister Zvi. The PFLP claimed responsibility for Zvi's assassination. So how did the PFLP react? The PFLP reacted with the threat to kill Palestinian security chiefs unless their guy was released. They claimed that Arafat had buckled in to Israeli and American dictates. All right, January 20th, 2002, first woman suicide bomber. This is a very sad story. A 28-year-old Palestinian medic, she's a medical, her job was as a medic, medical person. A 28-year-old Palestinian medic, Wafa Idris, was the first woman to ever carry out a suicide mission. Her mother called her a hero and a martyr. And here's a picture of Wafa Idris on the right and her mom on the left. Her mom was proud of her. She was a martyr and a hero. Very sad. It's forbidden under Islamic law for a woman to commit suicide for any reason. And Wafa Idris was not religious. She did not pray. So she wasn't even a religious Muslim. But the attack set new security standards for Israel. Every Palestinian man, woman, and child is now a potential suspect. First was every Palestinian man, then every Palestinian man and boy, child. Now it's every Palestinian man, woman, and child. Potential terrorist. Now, while Islamic theology promises extravagant rewards to male martyrs, it's not so clear what promises are made to women suicide bombers. Now, in June of 2002, a few months further on, there had been a second female suicide bombers hit Israel. And the news media, Meret, on June 5th of 2002, reported that the two female suicide bombers to date were both divorced, shunned by their families, and felt that their lives were over anyway. They were recruited as a way of bringing honor to themselves after disgracing their families. What a sad, sad story. What a sad, sad culture. That these women would feel so alienated and so criticized by their culture, that they would seek the way out and seek honor for themselves by being a suicide bomber. Very sad culture. See what Israel is dealing with, the attitudes that Israel is dealing with. All right, let's move on to February 3rd, 2002, the northern border grows warmer. Israeli foreign press asserted that Iran had supplied Hezbollah militants in Lebanon with 8,000 missiles that could hit Israeli cities. He warned Lebanon that Israel would not tolerate missile attacks from Lebanese territory. But February 7th, 2002, Qassam 2 missiles were seized and launched. So Qassam missiles started falling on Israel. Page 317. February 14, 2002. Ambulances and medical vehicles are used by terrorists. Terrorists are making more and more use of ambulances than medical vehicles. They're working on the prevalence that these vehicles do not undergo thorough examinations when passing through IDF checkpoints. The first woman bomber, Wafa Idris, apparently was transported in this manner using a Red Crescent ambulance. Remember, she was a medic. So she was apparently brought into Israel using an ambulance. She was a medical secretary for the Palestinian Red Crescent. Ambulance drivers, because they have relatively easy movement around the West Bank, have served as messengers for Hamas. Accordingly, Israel tightened up security checks on all medical vehicles. On April 1, 2002, a Red Crescent ambulance was found carrying a bomb. The bomb was hidden underneath a gurney where a sick Palestinian child was lying. That's great cover, again, using children and illness and an ambulance to hide a weapon. It was removed from the ambulance and detonated in the presence of representatives of the International Red Cross. The driver confessed that he tried to smuggle the bomb in and that it was not the first time that an ambulance had been used to transfer terrorists or bombs. For example, at the end of June 2002, IDF soldiers stopped two Palestinian ambulances for a routine check and found 27 people packed inside them. An ambulance going into Israel with 27 people jammed inside. 10 of those men were suspected of involvement in shooting or bomb attacks. And of course, the use of ambulances in this manner is a direct violation of the Geneva Convention. But I think you can see that agreements like the Geneva Convention mean nothing to Islamic terrorists or to the PA. All right, February 14, 2002, we're on page 317. Under pressure, Arafat draws a gun. Reports have circulated that PA Chairman Arafat lashed out against the head of PA Preventive Security, Jibril Rajoub. Rajoub is considered the second most powerful figure in the PA, commanding a force of 4,000 Palestinian plainclothesmen and uniformed agents. He also seemed as the likely successor to Arafat. Arafat is reported to have been reacting to reports that Rajoub's forces failed to resist a mob that overran the PA prison in Hebron, releasing 17 Islamic militants. Arafat then ordered the militants jailed at the request of the United States. Apparently, Arafat demanded to know why Rajoub's men had permitted the prisoner release. Rajoub became angry and blamed the incident on the absence of any clear policy from Arafat. Rajoub was not willing to act and take risks that are not clearly spelled out in writing and authorized by Arafat, because Arafat avoids documenting his instructions. And the subsequent events are kind of hazy. One report says that Arafat threw a screaming fit at Rajoub, accusing him of plotting to oust Arafat. He cursed him, he threatened him, he punched him and slapped him across the face. Most say that Arafat pulled his pistol on the security chief and, shaking with rage, may have dropped it. The details are impossible to confirm. Some intelligence officials claim the story is a fabrication intended for the benefit of the U.S. Interesting. Trying to deceive the U.S. into thinking there was rifts in the Palestinian Authority. And it was designed to prove his dedication to curbing the violence. However, if the report is substantially accurate, it indicates that there are serious cracks in the PA and that Arafat is losing control of his organization. In addition, the story indicates that Rajoub may be positioned to succeed Arafat. And Rajoub's dismissal in July indicates that the report may be factual. It may be factual. All right, let's turn to page 318. March 11, 2002, Israel lifts Arafat's detention. Yasser Arafat met a Cree Israeli demand after 3 months of defiant resistance. Palestinian police arrested all five terrorists wanted for the assassination of Israeli Cabinet Minister Rehavam Zvi. Arafat will be free to travel in the PA areas, but will have to ask permission to travel abroad. March 13, 2002, National Security Council endorses a Palestinian state. The UN Security Council passed a resolution endorsing the creation of a Palestinian state for the first time and called for an immediate ceasefire. The United States introduced the resolution, which was approved by 14 to 15 members. Syria abstained. The Palestinians welcomed the resolution. Now, highlight the next sentence. Israel stated that if such a state was demilitarized, created through negotiations, and would live at peace with its neighbors, Israel would accept it. Minister of Foreign Affairs Peres stated that, quote, Israel is a party to the desire to achieve an immediate ceasefire through the implementation of the Mitchell and Tenet plans in order to pave the way toward a renewal of the peace process and return to the negotiating table. So Israel always, always seeks peace. March 28, 2002, we'll close with this. A 25-year-old Palestinian terrorist, aligned with Hamas, walked into the dining room of the Park Hotel in Netanya, where 250 guests were beginning their Passover Seder, and detonated himself. He was disguised as a woman and slipped by the guards. And here's a map. On the left, you can see the area of Israel that is marked out in the rectangle on the right. Here is the area where this occurred. This is in Netanya, about the middle of the country, on the coastline. Netanya, in the middle of the country. And here's the Park Hotel. This is where this incident occurred. The blast led to the deaths of 29 people and injured 140. The attack became known as the Passover Massacre. The next day, Arafat announced he was ready to work towards an immediate ceasefire. He said he was willing to unconditionally implement the Tenet and Mitchell Report, and then he went on to say, quote, "Unfortunately, there are some aggressive preparations by the Israelis to do a wide military operation against our civilians, targeting our people and our Palestinian authority." Just an update. In 2003, four Hamas operatives were arrested for orchestrating the Passover massacre. April 4, 2003, they were sentenced to a military court to 29 life sentences, one life sentence for every life that they took. So a few years later, they were arrested. All righty. I want to close by recommending this DVD to you, Israel in a Time of Terror, by Dennis Prager. It's a 60-minute DVD dealing with this era in the history of the State of Israel. It's very good. Dennis Prager is the host from Vanguard. It's available on Amazon.com. So I would really advise you to get this DVD and look at it at this time to get a very, very close-up look at all that was happening in Israel in 2001 and 2002. All right, we'll pick it up next time on page 319, March 29, 2002, Operation Protective Wall, Operation Defensive Shield. So we'll pick it up next week at that point.